Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're ready for our next speaker. If everybody will take a seat. The next presentation is The Best Baseball Story Ever, A Critique of Bleacher Bums, Beloved to Us Chicagoans, by David Krell.
Thank you. You know, I see some familiar faces, and it's funny because during the last presentation, this is a hard act to follow, there was a woman at the back of the room, and she motioned me over, and I thought she was going to say that she saw me maybe at a Cooperstown symposium or a Negro League conference or maybe in Houston last year, and she motioned me over, and she said, "I just want you to know that when you spoke at the Negro League conference in Newark, you gave my family a restaurant recommendation, and we still talk about it." So apparently, SABRE stands for Society for American Baseball Restaurants when people are talking to me. But in that line, Bill Rizek and I went to dinner last night at Gene and Giorgetti's. So if you are staying here tonight, I highly, highly recommend it. I want to start with a question, and I want you to talk to your neighbor for 1 minute. If you were going to explain the history of the Chicago Cubs to somebody who knew nothing about baseball, where would you start? Would you start with Wrigley Field? Would you start with the rooftops on the buildings across the street? Would you start with Ernie Banks? Would you start going back to the 19th century? Where would you start? So 1 minute, just talk to your neighbor and back and front, to the left or right, and then I'll take a couple of examples. Okay, time's up. I'll take any volunteer, not the Sox fans. Sox fans don't count. We're talking about the Cubs. So any Cubs fans, any history fans, don't make me call on anyone. Just anyone. Yes, David. Okay. Yes.
100, a century of baseball futility in a very good ball.
Okay. One more.
Multiple losers.
And I saw one hand over here. Okay. I might start with Bleacher Bums, because to me that was an education when I started to think about what I wanted to present and what would be, you know, what would mesh with this city and with this SABRE conference. I came across the play Bleacher Bums, which I had heard of, but I had never read and certainly had never seen. It's about a group of fans, if you haven't seen it, it's about a group of fans who gamble during the course of a game between the Cubs and the Cardinals. Now, I can tell you that gambling is not allowed, obviously, but through the play, through these characters, you learn that they really do love the Chicago Cubs. The main character, if there is a main character in the ensemble, is Decker. There is Marvin, who's kind of a sharpie. He's kind of a taunter. There's Richie, who's kind of a nebbish when it comes to baseball, and he's just there tagging along with Decker. There's Greg, the blind guy, who gives a play-by-play. There's Melody, the busty blonde, who just wants to suntan. There is Zig, who is just the most frustrated gambler there is, and his wife, who comes halfway through the play. And what's interesting to me is Melody and Zig's wife, the two women in the play, they're kind of outsiders, but they become a part of it by the end. The conception for this started with Joe Mantegna, who you may know from Criminal Minds and The Godfather 3, where he played Joey Zaza. He was a part of a theater workshop called the Organic Theater Company. And the Organic Theater Company is a workshop. Struggling actors need to put on plays very cheaply. So he had an idea during one of their meetings. He said, "I've been bouncing around this concept. I've been going to Cubs games since I was 5. Now you come with me to a game and you tell me if there's not a story based on these characters." So they went to a game and they studied these guys in the stands and they took notes. And they put on this play. Now, it was so successful in terms of its impact that Linda Weiner, who was the theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, wrote this. beer, popcorn, baseball, gambling compulsions, winner-loser obsessions, and team fanaticisms for all in Bleacher Bums. Since I don't care about any of the above except maybe popcorn, and I wouldn't cross a wide alley for that, and since the national pastime has never been mine, and since all Wrigley Field ever symbolized to me was traffic congestion on Addison Street, consider this. If I like Bleacher Bums, anybody could. And she goes on to say, this is an emotional pushover of a play, as much about faith, enthusiasm, fantasy, and ritual as about Cubs fans at the game. The maligned wife gets vindicated and a bit patronized as a baseball sharpie. The likable blind man with the transistor radio gets the busty blonde. The slow-witted fellow gets defended, and everybody comes out to protect the hyperkinetic kid bouncing around for team frenzy. The comedy almost gets serious about problem gambling, then perhaps unfortunately shies away from dampening the opportunity for baseball bonanza. So that's someone who, like the theater, did not know anything about baseball, did not care anything about baseball, but it grabbed her. She really took to these characters. It's interesting that at the what I would consider the climax is when Richie wins. He wins a bet. He catches a game ball, and he gets so excited. And Marvin just puts him down, to the shock of everybody. And he tells him, "You don't belong here. You don't rate here. We feel sorry for you. We pity you." And there's this silence that falls upon the other characters. So there's no mistake that the other characters pair off. There's Decker and Richie, there's Greg and Melody, there's Zig, who has a newfound compassion and love for his wife, who proves to know something about baseball. She just doesn't like the gambling. She certainly doesn't like that her husband goes day after day to the bleachers and gambles based on who's going to get to first base and how many home runs will be hit, etc. Now, in 2001, there was a Showtime TV movie, and that had a lot of differences between, you know, that there were a lot of differences between that story and the play. First of all, there are no Major League Baseball logos or names in the movie, because by 2001, Major League Baseball wised up and they said, this is about gambling. We cannot have something with gambling associated with baseball. It's just not going to happen. So if you watch the movie, and I watched it this morning on DVD, it's the St. Louis Eagles and the Chicago Bruins. Wrigley Field is Lakeview Park. And they don't mention anything about any Major League Baseball players, no names. I think Sammy Sosa becomes Manny Losa. But, and this is the third time I've watched it, and I picked up something that I didn't pick up before. Wayne Knight, who played Newman in Seinfeld, you all remember that? Hello, Newman. He says in a group shot, wide shot, he says something about, he's the worst player in the National League. And then he turns to the cast members and says, oh, I'm not supposed to say that. So I don't know if the director left that in or if the director didn't catch it. Another interesting thing about the TV movie, they added a couple of components. First of all, you see the field. And that's obviously something you can't do. Bleacher Bums, as I said, was produced very cheaply. They just had a few risers, 8 cast members, not in any real costume changes or anything like that, some extras. But here you saw the players warming up, and you see it through Greg's eyes, or rather his ears. There's an overhead shot of the fans coming into the ballpark, but he's the first cast member you see. And you see him smile. He hears the bat hitting the ball. He hears the players shouting to each other and warming up. But the thing that is also interesting to me is that Decker has a son in this play. So there's a more human element. And the son obviously knows about baseball. At one point, he was a prospect, in Decker's eyes, he was. And now he wants to start a band. He needs $2,000 from his father. And by the end of the play, he gets it. Or by the end of the movie, he gets it. They also show the iconic scoreboard, and Decker's son, Joey, gets to go up to the scoreboard and go inside. There are all sorts of legends that the guys talk about, that they have broads up there and all sorts of parties and beer. It's actually Charles Durning and another actor, Maury Chaykin, who was in, what's the one with Joe Pesci? My Cousin Vinny. and he played Nero Wolfe in a series of TV movies. And they're just two friendly older gentlemen who just love baseball, and Joey can't see it. He gets up there during the rain delay, but Joey just sees an empty ballpark during the rain delay. He doesn't grab the history. They mentioned the Mendoza line. You all know what the Mendoza line is, right? Yes? A mark of mediocrity. Now, just by a show of hands, how many people think that the Mendoza line is fixed at 200? And how many people think it's a floating line? The same argument takes place in the movie, which shows you that baseball arguments are just not going to go away. Richie is also different in the TV movie. It's almost, and if you watch it on YouTube, if you watch the play on YouTube, I believe it was taped in the late 70s and it aired in 1984, am I right, on WTTW. Richie is almost, and I'm not joking around or making fun, but he's almost mentally challenged. It's overacting to a certain degree. Now, in the theater, you have to, I don't want to say overact, but you have to emphasize certain things because the person in the back seat in the back of the theater isn't going to pick up facial gestures or tics or winks or anything like that that the TV movie does. Richie's just a younger guy who looks up to Decker. He's his official scorekeeper, his lucky scorekeeper. You also see their lives. You see that Zig and his wife have somewhat of a marriage, but the wife makes her living by selling things on eBay. You see that Melody not only wants to go suntanning, she wants to be the next Pamela Anderson. Pamela Anderson got discovered by, I think it was Labatt's, the beer company, because the cameraman focused on her during a college football game. And that's when her career started. So Melody in the TV movie, she wants that. She wants that big break. She watches a VHS of herself before she goes to the Bruins game. And she was getting that exposure until the guys behind her were jostling beer and it dumped on her. So the announcers went from making her a sex symbol to making her a joke. So she tried to do the same thing, in this game, but she found Greg instead. So what is the legacy of Bleacher Bums? Well, I want to start by talking about the legacy of the Chicago Cubs, and I don't think you could really talk about that without talking about George Will. So I consulted this very handy little book, A Nice Little Place on the North Side, that should be in every baseball historian's collection. And he says about Wrigley Field, "She stands alone at the corner of Clark and Addison, this dowager queen dressed in basic black and pearls, 75 years old, proud head held high, and not a hair out of place, awaiting yet another date with destiny, another time for Mr. Wright. She dreams as old ladies will of men gone long ago, Joe Tinker, Johnny Evers, Frank Chance, and of those of recent vintage like her man Ernie and the lion Leo DeRocher and sweet Billy Williams. And she thinks wistfully of what might have been, and the pain is still fresh and new, and her eyes fill, her lips tremble, and she shakes her head ever so slightly. And then she sighs, pulls her shawl tightly around her frail shoulders, and thinks, this time it will be better." That's a quote from Vin Scully during the 1989 championship series between the Cubs and the Giants. Marvin, as I said, or should have said, everybody pairs off but Marvin. He's the most cynical, edgy character in the whole play, and he's kind of just left alone at the end of the play and at the end of the movie. There's a quote that he has which I think symbolizes what the play is all about and what Cubs fans are all about. He says, "All I hear is 35,000 people about to get their hearts broken. But I want to contrast that with Greg's speech at the end." Marvin asks Greg, you need a ride home, obviously, because Greg's blind. And Greg says this, "If you're smart, tomorrow you'll bet it on the Cubs, because tomorrow they're going to win. Because they're mad now, and when you're mad, they get up and go. As a matter of fact, they're not only going to win tomorrow, they're going to take the rest of this series. They're going to win three from Pittsburgh, or they're going to take that series from Philadelphia. Sosa's going to hit 350. So will Grace. Wood's going to be a 20-game winner. And so will Tapani and Beck. Marv, can you believe this? Beck's not going to lose another game. His earned run average is going to be .0000001. And at the end of this season, they're going to win the pennant. And Marv, guess what? The Sox win too. See, I got something in there for you. Could you see that? They'll call it the Buck 50 series because that's how much it costs to go on the L between here and Comiskey. And they'll play this series. It'll go the full seven games. They'll be in the seventh. They'll be all tied up in the 23rd inning because it's a pitcher's duel. And then you know what's going to happen? They're going to bring an Ernie Banks out of retirement. He's going to hit a home run right into my lap, and they're going to win the World Series. And that is when you can give me a ride home. So I picked those two quotes specifically because I think it shows the contrast. There's hope, and then there's hope with cynicism. I'm almost out of time. The real legacy of a creative work is how long it's in existence, how long people talk about it. I think people will be talking about Bleacher Bums for another 37 years, 38 years at least, because earlier this year, it was produced in Rome, Georgia. It's not just a Chicago play, it's a baseball play. I interviewed Joe Mantegna for an article that's in the National Pastime. I interviewed Dennis Paoli, who was a crucial part of the dialogue in the original play. And they both told me from time to time they get calls, and it is produced by other cities. They just change the names. And I think that's the legacy, because everybody in this room has a favorite team. Any Yankee fans here? Good. Everybody in this room has had a team that we root for, despite being cynical, despite being edgy about it, despite being, I don't know, a little pessimistic, but we still go to the ballpark and we still root for them. And I think that's what the legacy of Bleacher Bums is. Thank you.
Anybody who has any questions can line up on
questions,
either side.
Questions, rebuttal.
We have time.
No questions?
I have a question.
Oh, he has a question.
It's been restaged in Chicago over the years,
yes,
periodically, and it's always gotten a big crowd. But do you know what they've changed every time they've restaged it?
Well, I know they changed the names, because what I just read from is the 1998 version, not the 1977 version.
Right. The original had the 77 Cardinals in their horrible specificity.
And if you pay attention, what Dennis Paoli told me was, if you pay close attention to the play, you can follow the game. You can almost score the game based on the announcing and based on, you know, their reactions to it. So there is an actual game. It's not just superfluous that they're betting on this or betting on that. There is an actual structure to it. Anything else? I knew John was going to ask a question.
Well, when I was in Baltimore, Barry Levinson and Diner, it was all about his old buddies. They used to hang out at the diner, even though it was kind of fictional. Was there really a group that they modeled these Bleacher Bums after?
Not only was there a group, but they got nervous that the actors were cops because they were coming into the ballpark and looking at them and taking notes.
Okay.
And one funny thing, I don't know if Mr. Mantegna said it to me or if I found it during the research. I think I found it during the research. They invited the actual Bleacher Bums to come to a staging. And one of the characters, and it's clear who it is, comes up to the cast and says, "I loved that. Which one was I?" He had no idea. He had absolutely no idea. Dennis Franz played Zig in the original. I think in the 89 version, Dennis Farina played him. And he was just coming off a show called Crime Story, where he played a Chicago cop. For those who don't know, Dennis Farina was a Chicago cop for almost 20 years, and he got into theater while he was a cop, and then got into more, I guess, visible roles. No one knew him before Crime Story, except in Chicago. Yes?
Was Mantegna himself?
Yes. Yes. It says here, conceived by Joe Mantegna, and then it's written with a bunch of other people who are in the workshop. So it's very much a collaborative effort. But the genesis of it started with him in that meeting saying, I've been having this idea for some time. you know, let's do some research. So it really started with him. He played Decker. Yeah. Yeah, Roberta Custer recently died within the past month.
Mm-hmm.
77 is it was the first presentation at Organic. It went bigger. I think it went to Broadway in New York the year after, but it was reproduced in Chicago in 1989 and several times in other cities. Yeah, I've heard that. I'm presuming he played Zig. Yeah, it seems like he would be playing Zig.
I didn't hear the question.
George Wendt from Cheers played Zig in a succeeding production. Abby, how are we doing on time? Is that about it? Any other questions, comments, rebuttal? Awesome. Thank you for your time.